Intervju Radija Študent.
V današnjem Erich intervjuju se pogovarjamo s Kenom Vandermarkom, pihalcem iz Chicaga, ki je v zasedbah Sax & Drums ter Side A minule dni nastopil na jazz festivalu Ljubljana. Nekaj smo rekli o improvizaciji, pa o ženskah v jazzovski godbi in tudi kako besedo o njegovem sodelovanju z osrednjim saksofonom letošnjega festivala Petrom Brocmanom. Prisluhnite torej pogovoru, ki ga je s Kenom posnel Anže Zorman.
Mr. Vandermark, yesterday you played here in Sax & Drums Quartet with Peter Brocman, Jaime Drake and Chet Taylor. And can you tell me, was the thing wholly improvised or did you know what's gonna happen?
The show was completely improvised. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about the music beforehand and everything that was made was spontaneous.
But do you have any preconceived notions of what you're gonna do, any ideas that you want to develop in this specific context?
No, I mean, it always works better when you leave your expectations behind and just deal with the situation as it develops and use the music that's played as source material each time you you do an improvised concert. At least in my experience, it works better. If you go in with expectations or you think certain things will happen, you start looking for them and missing the things that are actually happening right around you, you know?
But I wondered, you started with a very strong melody. Yesterday, what? It just came to you then specific moment and you didn't know what you're gonna play, what's gonna happen with the melody 5 seconds after.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways I think improvising is like having a conversation, you know. We're talking now, I don't know what your questions are gonna be. You mentioned that it's gonna be a discussion about Peter's work, so I know some of the subject matter, but the same thing's true with music. I mean, I knew Hamid and Chad and Peter, I played with all of them. I have a sense of their backgrounds, their interest in music, and that plays into my decisions, but I don't have I'm going to play this melody I worked up in the hotel room during the afternoon, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like that.
But still, you had almost an hour and a half of music. Do you have to sort of control yourself not to, let's say, repeat yourself in the same melodic themes?
Yeah, that's what I mean, is that when the concert starts, that's the material. So if something's happened earlier, like there was some sections where Peter and I were playing together, and when it happened later in the concert, I knew that I would have to try to do some different things, so I didn't repeat myself. But that's an awareness of what's been played, not so much like imposing a set of decisions from outside the concert, but referencing the concert itself and what's happened, and to help construct something that makes sense musically and also develops where it started to where it ends, you know?
But you said it's a dialogue, but sometimes when one sees such a powerful concert, one wonders is how much of that is actually a duel. Did it happen that you actually, in a way, fought with Peter for dominance in a way of which the music is going to go?
I don't think I understand your question, I'm sorry.
Does it happen that you want to, let's say, impose an idea of yours and Peter wants to impose another one? Does it happen that you vie for dominance?
I wouldn't call it vying for dominance, but I do think that there's something about fighting for your ideas. And one of the nice things about working with Peter is that he has very strong, clear ideas. And you can push against those, you can go with them, you can do something in contrast, but you really are building with material with him. He's not going to just sort of do something indifferently. And I think that things work well with him because of that. He's very definitive in his statements. And so sometimes it's like, well, he's going to go to the left and maybe I'm going to go straight this way with my ideas, but I don't give up on them, you know, and that creates a kind of interesting musical tension. And he's really a master at that. I mean, his whole career has been about in many cases creating situations where creative ideas are antagonistic but then result in really good music, and I've learned a lot from working with him because of that.
On the exhibition up there, there is a text about Peter, and there it says that he's like a whirlwind.
He's like a whirlwind?
Yeah, and okay. Everything just happens around him, but it also sort of says that, in a way, he may be more of a leader than a follower. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't have the feeling that things just happen around Peter. I think Peter makes things happen.
Yeah,
he makes them happen, and he's definitely a leader. I mean, in terms of, like, he has his own direction. He works with people that he can collaborate with and that challenge him. Yeah. He doesn't, I think, look for people who are just going to support his ideas. He wants to be pushed. He wants to be challenged. And I think that he also is an individual. I don't think my impression is he's not concerned with, like, whatever is the hip thing to do, whatever is new. He's interested in doing something that excites him, and he's had decades and decades of experience playing all kinds of music in all kinds of contexts all over the world, and I think that those things inform his decisions, and he's not concerned what people think about if it's a good choice or bad choice because he believes in what he's doing so strongly. I think that's paid off really well for him. He's an amazing artist, you know.
Yeah. Another thing that comes to mind a lot of times, especially when listening to the two of you and also to Mats Gustafsson and to the Sonora, I'd say, it's a very masculine music. Mm. Could you elaborate on that? Do you agree or maybe?
I would say that I think I understand what you mean, but I also think that these things are more complicated than that. I think that there's lots of elements in Peter's music that are extremely romantic, also his visual art.
Yeah.
And I think quite beautiful even from a conventional standpoint. I think that he's been kind of put into a box in some sense because, you know, a lot of his work is very strong, like very aggressive maybe, powerful. But I think that it's not just a singular thing. If it was, it'd become boring after a while. You'd be numb to it. And the thing is that he's a very diverse player with a wide range of expression. And a lot of it's conventionally, like I said, beautiful. And I think that if you break down ideas about music or art into, like, what's male and what's female, you know, Peter is a mix of things. And so I don't think the music is limited to, like, a male perspective. I think it's much broader than that. And I think that, for example, I know a lot of women who like really aggressive music. That's, you know, so I don't think it's so simple a thing like
actually,
that.
Actually, that's what I wanted to ask. You know of any female saxophone player who could, let's say, join in the kind of music that was taking place yesterday?
Let's see, female saxophone players. I'm going to space out on her name right now. She's living in Denmark. Lotta Anker. She's a really great saxophone player, female saxophone player. I also think that, you know, there's different predilections in what people want to do. And there's such a long history in improvised music of, like, this very intense kind of playing that, as more and more women get involved in improvised music and finding their own voices, the natural thing in all art is a dialectic where they push against the paradigm that existed before. You know, you see it in the visual arts all the time, the same thing with music. And so if you have a situation where there's been a paradigm that's very strong in terms of volume, in terms of density, in terms of aggression, raw sounds, atonal sounds, let's say, just to totally simplify things. And you have people coming into the music, male or female, now, who are in their 20s, the natural reaction to that would be to do something different. That's been done, that's been worked with, to simplify. I think there's a lot more you can do with these materials, too. So I think that in some cases, you know, women who are coming into the music now, they're going to try to find something different rather than imitate something that is outside of their own experience, you know. They want to try something new, and that's going to mean different music. So, like, was it Christian Avalor? She plays a totally different kind of music, you know, and I don't think that's just because she's female. I think she's responding to the environment that came before her to say, well, what can I do? What can I contribute? How do I do something different, you know? So I think there's a complexity there than just male or female.
But still the same, the females are less present in the jazz scene. And since you've been in the scene for a long time in many different projects, does it bother you actually that such a disparity exists? Or even have you done something against it?
Yeah, I mean, it's confusing to me. You know, I don't really understand it because the vast majority of people I work with are extremely open. I mean, anybody who plays whatever kind of playing they bring to the table, if they have something to say, people are curious about it. If they're dedicated to developing their music, people are interested in it. So in my experience, I have not encountered male musicians who are like antagonistic towards women being able to play the music. I really, honestly, thinking now, I can't think of somebody who has that attitude that women can't play, because that's just bullshit. I mean, it's ridiculous. But it is curious that there aren't more women involved, and I think part of that, I've talked to lots of different people, both men and women, about it, and I think it's changing. I think more and more women are being involved, and I think that's because the music has shifted away from a really strong jazz history connected to improvised music and moving more into an open field of improvised music. So people can play without knowing the music of Charlie Parker, for example. And there's a history in jazz, or connected to the history of jazz, I should say, of people trying to outplay another person. It's like a competitiveness. At its best, it creates really amazing music. You know, Sonny Stitt and Art Pepper, you know, competing on a playing over a tune, and who can play faster, who can play more intensely. You know, Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young competing in these famous jam sessions and whatnot that are legendary. In general, I mean, and these things are really need to be understood as generalities because it's not specific. Most women are socially minded, not independently minded, you know, so they see a bigger picture than most men. Most men are very single-minded about their own direction and their objectives, whereas women are much more curious about interplay, which works extremely well in improvisation. But I could see how the history of jazz and who's the fastest, who's the best, who can play longest, who can play loudest, who's more intense, they're not interested in that. They're interested in something that's more unilateral. And I think that as the music moves further away from a real jazz basis, the American jazz basis, and develops into a whole range of things that incorporate new music from late 20th century composition to music from around the world, more in the line of what Don Cherry started innovating. As all these things, for example, rock music, start coming more and more in. If you look at rock music, there's lots of women who play. So it's not about music and women. It's about this weird lineage connected, I think, to jazz and the perceptions about jazz, right or wrong. And I think that's going to start changing in the next decade a lot. There's a lot more women playing, doing really amazing things. And most of those women, I think, if you look and listen to what they're doing, it would fall outside of what is conventionally thought of as jazz music. It's working with improvisation and maybe referencing jazz, but it's really moving up further afield from that. And I think as that happens, you're going to see more and more women involved.
Well, I talked to Mary Halverson. She said that it could also be the fact that the musical education system is much more conservative, and only when she broke free of the school system, she felt accepted into the musical happenings.
Yeah, I can see that too. I mean, because a lot of the schooling is based on schooling connected to what jazz history is about, and in many cases, it's misguided. I mean, if you compare the scene connected to Brooklyn and New York to the scene in Chicago, there's a lot more women involved in the scene in New York and Brooklyn than in Chicago. And I know that that's not because the scene in Chicago is so patriarchal, but the education systems in Chicago are very, very jazz-based. The academic situation there is quite conservative. Whereas, you know, in the New York area, you have Wesleyan, where Anthony Braxton taught for a long time, where George Lewis is teaching at Columbia. You've got much more open-mindedness going on in programs in that area, and it's not so conservative, and I think women feel much more open to pursue their own ideas about music or about improvised music, and so you have more people active in those scenes. No one who's 17, 18 years old is going to come to Chicago for the academic scene. They may come for the music scene, because that's been very open, but the school system or the school programs connected to music are extremely conservative, and that's going to create the situation that Mary talks about. Like, you know, you have to leave that to find an environment that's embracing you. And I think that women aren't going to be motivated to come study in Chicago because the programs are so conservative. And I think that contributes to it too.
Well, going back to the very hairy man, Mr. Rotzman, do you remember when did you first play with him?
First played with him... Geez. Well, that would have been with Chicago, the early version of the Chicago Tintet. I was asked to join that, and that would have been like in 1998, I think. And that was a group mostly of Chicagoans. I think Joe McPhee was in the first version, but a lot of the core of the Chicago Tintet, it was an octet, I think, the first time.
Yeah. But did your relation with Mr. Rotzman on stage, did it evolve? Did you feel intimidated by his presence from the start?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I still feel intimidated. You know, I mean, it's he's an essential musician, and he's always challenging you to try to find your own voice on stage. And yeah, it's intimidating, but you can't let that prevent you from playing who you are. You know, that's not what he wants. He doesn't want someone to duplicate what he's doing. He's already done it. He's already working with it. No one's going to do it better than him. So I'm much more interested in finding my own stuff. And he's been very instrumental in me discovering what my own voice is, you know?
And what about...
Oh, come ahead. It doesn't matter.
It's just...
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah. This will be the highlight. You don't even have to... Yeah, it's okay.
What about when do you hear his first album? That was probably a slightly longer time ago.
Well, the first album I heard by him? Well, like a lot of people, the first album I heard was Machine Gun.
Yeah.
And I heard that in 1986. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of people, it like completely changed my thinking about stuff. And I know he's sick and tired of hearing about Machine Gun, but it is a seminal record. The thing is that he's done a lot of seminal records since then, and Peter's work is extremely diverse, and it continues to evolve. I mean, he's going to be playing with his trio, with Steve Noble and John Edwards, in a couple of days. He's working with Jason Adashevitz now. He's always looking for new people to play with because he wants to be challenged. His music is always evolving. I mean, he has a voice, but his voice has a huge range to it, you know, and I think that's not going to stop until he's gone.
What about his painting? Art, have you known it before?
Yeah.
And could you say, at least that was my impression, that his painting is much more darker than his music? I mean, his music is ecstatic in a way, lyrical, while the paintings do have more a slightly darker tone. Could you say that?
I don't know if I agree with that, because if you look at all the watercolors, they're very light. There's lots of color to them. And I think, again, you know, even with the darker, intense paintings, I mean, there's dark, intense parts of his music, you know. You have to look at the big picture. If you walk through the whole exhibition, and I've seen lots of his work at a number of exhibitions in different places in the world, and I've seen the work, I've been lucky enough to see the work at his house, and, you know, on some occasions. There's a lot of range there. Yeah, there's the very heavy, you know, black tone paintings, but then there's a lot, you know, the watercolors are the totally different feeling, and that's part of the big picture with him. And I think that with any great artist, you really can't look for a quote unquote the masterpiece. You have to look at the body of work. And with Peter, there's a lot of range there, both as a visual artist and as a musician. And I think that you really hear his music in his visual art, and you really see, how do you say, hear his music, and in his music you visualize what he creates with his painting. They're very much the same person, different aspects to his expression, but very consistent.
Well, I think we're gonna have to finish now. Thank you very much for your time and your answers, and have a good festival.
I am.
Intervju Radija Študent.